So this morning we're going to talk about the economics of construction. There's actually various articles, if you ever want to Google it or whatever, they're talking about the economic equation. The concept here is what we're going to talk about generally is when you're developing a project as the owner, and the owner can be the government, the owner could be a private investor, the owner could be a homeowner, the owner could be a not-for-profit. There's different types of analyses that the owner goes through and the economics of why it makes sense to build what they're going to build and how they're going to build it. You know, like if you think about it, if you want to build a house, you got to look at how much money you make and how much you can get as a mortgage and everything else. So you do that and you put your budget together. If you're going to build a factory, you're going to amortize the value of that factory over probably 20, 30 years. So when you look at the price of what it costs, and you offset that against your revenues and lines of credit and everything else, you know that building is going to be producing revenue for you for 30 years. And so how does that economic equation work in? If you're the government, do we have enough money for the taxpayers? Or even if we don't, can we get bonds? How do we deal with that? So those are some things but they're all three different, very different analyses of how and why we do that. So everything we're going to talk about today is like a 30,000 feet. If you want to get in, if any of this thing is interesting to you, like I said, you can go and Google, you can look at various articles on stuff like this. It's actually kind of fascinating when you start looking at least from my standpoint, maybe not you guys, but from my standpoint, it's kind of fascinating to think about that. Because when I'm talking to clients, you know, they're always looking at the bottom dollar. They want to make sure that the project is done on time and on budget. On time and on budget is like the gold standard. If you can do that, then you get, you know, the contractors get more business. When you're late and you have problems with budget and everything else and the owner hasn't changed anything, contractors don't survive. So those things all factor into it, and the owner, when they're looking at it as their side, maybe it's a corporation and they gotta respond and they owe responsibilities and fiduciary duties to their stockholders or to the officers and directors, so depending on who's doing that. I got a project right now that's going on out in California. It's a two-phase project. They brought a guy in to help this. It's a company that makes plant-based milk products. They're expanding one of their lines, and he was brought in specifically for these two phases of the project. So his value to the company and his year-end bonus and all those other things are going to tie back to if he got the project done on time and on budget. So all these things factor in. So we'll talk about those. So when we look at the economics, we need to make the decisions. There's four basic decisions you want to think about, economic decisions. There are many, many subsets of these, but again, I want to keep things pretty high up. So you're going to make economic decisions relating to the construction. That's the actual construction. How much is it going to cost? What are the project materials we're going to use? Where's the land it's going to be at? So the economic decisions looking at construction. And again, if you're developing a residential home, it's where you want to live in school districts or where it's close to downtown or those types of things. When you're developing a factory, is it going to be access to highways so you can get it in and out? When you're developing other things, sometimes taxes factor into it. Like when my wife and I were looking, when we moved here 16 years ago, moved up to our current house, we were in three or four neighborhoods, and the one neighborhood that we were able to get in, which was really nice, was in a Glenview tax district, but we are in the New Trier school district, so because it was much closer. So we were able to find a nice house that we liked. We were looking at places over there, but the tax situation was much higher. So those are all things that when you look in, we weren't building, but that's what you want to look at. Economic decisions related to the type of project. Again, are you building residential? Are you building industrial? Are you building civic? Those types of things. And who's making those decisions? And then how are you looking at the dollars that are important? Where are you getting the dollars? How are they being allocated? I represented McCormick Place and Navy Pier, the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, for about 15, 18 years. And everything that they did when we did all the construction had to be done by bonds that were approved by the state of Illinois. And so the legislature would approve bonds, and the bonds would then come to the MPEA, and they had their own operating, they actually had their own taxing district too. So some of their money came from hotel revenue and cab revenue and everything else, but they had to look where, what type of projects they were doing and where the money was coming from those type of projects. So, you know, we did We did a convention center. We did a couple of hotels. We did the arena over in Navy Pier. I did the whole horizontal renovation and what they had and where the sources of funds for that. Economic decisions related to the project outcome. What do you want from that project? Again, when I was with Haribo, being on time was huge because they needed to make sure they had a bunch of equipment being made over in Germany. And that equipment, when it was ready to come, needed to come over to the States. And then they needed to put it in and they needed to start generating revenue. So here you have a project, you spend all these hundreds of millions of dollars to build a factory. When does it start making revenue? How quickly can we get it up to speed? And so what's the project outcome? And then finally, economic review over the life of the project and building. And that's more residentially, like, you know, my house, and I'll pay my mortgage off in X number of years. That's great, and that's wonderful, and it's a payment that I don't have anymore. But I don't look at my economic analysis for what we bought necessarily for the life of the house. I mean, my wife and I knew this was going to be like probably the next house or next place we ever had. We'll be down to a tiny condo or something when it's just the two of us and we're much older. But we don't look at it that way on the residential side. But as I said, if you're going to be building a facility that's going to be a revenue generator, it's going to make money for you. So you're going to not have necessarily the capital and the cash fully in the beginning. But over the life of that building, it's going to make money back for you. So that's what you're going to look at. My undergraduate, I went to Notre Dame. So Notre Dame, their philosophy is they don't build any building until it's 100% paid for. So they have to go out and they make sure, and that's not paid for by getting loans and everything else. That's by they'll go out and they'll do fundraisers or whatever you want to call it, people that are donating to the university, and they set it aside. And so that's their requirement. That's one of the ways they do, because then they don't have to operate in the black. The architecture building at Notre Dame was built by Walsh Construction. I don't know if you guys know, they're one of the biggest in Chicago, they're one of the biggest in the country, Walsh Construction. They do really, really good work. And they actually, say what happens at, like many universities, if you donate enough money, you get your name on the building. So Walsh donated all the money for the building. He actually did that. And Notre Dame, they had another rule that's not related to the economics completely, but partly it is they do not allow any contractors that have donated money to build their own buildings. But for Walsh, they made one exception because he paid for 100% of it. It came out of zero revenue from the university. So it's the Walsh School of Architecture. They got to build it, and it was to his interest to get it done on time and on budget because it was his money. So it was the one exception they made. But it's all that economic. And when you look at a school, they're going to look at the life of the building in many respects because it's going to be used over and over. It's not a revenue generator, right, like, specific. It's not making money. But again, the students come, they have to have a place to live for residential. So they buy, it's an indirect revenue generator. So universities will look at that. And Willis Building is a building, something that can grow and expand. Probably you guys maybe talk about in design. I'm not sure, because a lot of you guys are in the urban world as much as designing buildings. But, you know, you got to make sure a building can expand for the future. You know, making sure, like, even my house, when my house that we bought had just been recently been, that we're currently in, had been gut rehabbed. It's 100 and some years old now. It was built in 1921. But the owner before had torn down all the walls and torn out everything and put in all new plumbing, all new wiring and everything else, and then wired the house for all cable and Cat 5 and everything else, and it's out of date. So, like, what are you doing when you're thinking about your projects as far as the life of the building and how it can expand and operate for you? So those are four big things that you want to think about on the economic side. Questions on that? Critical elements when you're doing this analysis. And these things, it's depending on who you are and depending on what type of project you are, you may be able to do it very basic. Residential, I'm going to go and I'm going to talk to my bank. I'm going to see how much money I have to put to a down payment. What's my mortgage? They're going to approve me for my my monthly payment. Can I make that? Do I make enough of my salary to do that? That's a very simple cost analysis, financial analysis, risk management, and contract management. It's really simple for me when I'm doing that when you buy a house. It's daunting. It's kind of overwhelming. It wasn't the first place I bought, but it was it was by far the largest investment that I ever did, and my wife had never bought a house, so because when we got married, I already owned my condo. So it was something that, you know, it's something you still have to go through. But when you're dealing with larger projects and you're looking at capital projects, are they raising money like Notre Dame does? They raise money to make sure they have enough in a capital project that they have all of it paid for. Or do we finance it? How do we finance it? If we're doing it like the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, we're financing it through bonds. At one time, we actually did a deal where it didn't work through because they were trying to figure out the bonding revenue wasn't available, and so we were going to go and try to do a grant back using where the bank loaned us money, and they would own the property, kind of like a mortgage, but not exactly, and then there, after a certain point, it would be granted back to us. So we would grant them the property, and they would grant it back. Didn't go through. We also really were able to do with bonds and revenue generation through the taxes of your cabs and your hotels and stuff to build the arena and the hotel. But that's all the things that go into it. And one of the things that we did when we were doing in McCormick Place, when we did the hotel and the arena, is we brought in somebody to do the specific financial analysis. And we had one person that was working the numbers if we were able to do it through bonds. And we had to do the analysis if we were able to do it through the banks. And then we went out to the market with the banks. We went out and actually shopped it around. And those are the types of things you're going to want to think about when you're doing that. It's not per se like when I take a project and I go out to bid and I get three contractors that are going to give me a price to build the project. It's the financial part of it. Where are you going to get that revenue? A client that I work with right now, they're developing, they're mostly in the hospitality industry of what they develop. So hotels, they just started getting into apartments and condos, high-end retail, so really nice stuff. So it's in the hospitality, mostly, like on the hospitality side, some restaurants, but again, the largest bulk of their business is hotels. And so the main owner of the company, because each one of the developments are single-purpose LLCs. We talked about that. So they developed an LLC for one in Indianapolis and an LLC for this city and that city and going forward. And so what the main guy, he's actually in the financial world. So he doesn't do real estate, but he's got lots of money for investment in the financial world. So he goes to his various investors in private equity and says, hey, we're putting together, we're going to build a hotel. So he gets investors, they create their own LLC. That investor will have enough money to say for 30-40% of the value of the project. That allows them to get the project up and running and going, and the investors are all in for their value. And then after things are started up, then they'll go to the banks and they'll finance the remainder of the project. And the banks, it's a pretty good deal for the bank because the owner's already put in 30% of the investment, so there's quite a bit of money that the bank doesn't have to take a risk, number one. Number two, the way their model is, they've got the designs completed and the contractor on board and they're already starting working. So when the bank comes in and says, am I going to give you the remaining 60% or 40% or whatever the value of the split is to finish this project, it's a good investment for them. So they make this financial analysis and the risk management, because they're going to the bank and saying, I need $100 million. It's not a small amount. But the bank says, this seems like already a deal that's pretty baked. And as long as it's got good cost estimate and good financial analysis before, I, as the bank, am looking good at it for my risk management. So those are types of things that they look to when you try to package deals together. Deals are done all different ways. Some deals are done with no money, and they get it all invested by banks and some things like that. So different ways to look at this as far as the critical elements. But these are four things that always will factor into that economic equation for a project. Any questions on that? Okay. So key elements of the construction economic is the value analysis. So now we know that we're looking at it, we have this project, we know what the project is, we've looked at long term, we've looked at short term, we looked at the financial stuff. But now, how much money will that project cost? So when we look to the designer, we have a budget and we have an idea of what the program should be. Those don't always match. If you think about it, the average person doesn't understand that this type of house or this type of strip mall or this type of school will cost X. They just don't have that background and that history and that knowledge. They can do some research and everything else, but they know, okay, I have this pot of money here, and I've got the design here, and I need to make sure my program, not my design, I need to make sure that what I want as the end product falls within my economic availability and is there value to it. So I'll go back to, and sometimes when you're working through things, the design and what those costs might be put you out of your budget. And do you want to spend, you know, we had the, if you remember on the B101 in Article 6, when you get to the end of the construction document, 6.6.4 says, if the lowest bona fide bid is higher than the construction estimate, the owner can do one of four things. They can increase the budget. They can go back to the architect and redesign. They can change the program, and I'm blanking on the fourth. But there are options available in the contract that says, is the project at the end, before you start building it, before you start going out, is it the right value for you? And it gives, in writing there, the owner the options of what to do. And so that's where you're looking at when you're talking about how much will the project cost. Wait a minute. This slide isn't right. There's three more. Hold on a second. Now I'm really mad at myself because those should have been changed. Hold on. Nope. All right, we're only going to talk about the one. Then you guys have to be tested on the other one. But I apologize for that. I'm looking at it now. I'm like, there's two other ones here, and these all say the same. Okay, well, we're just going to finish on the project cost one. I will send around the revised slide just so you can see it. I do apologize for that. I was working on it last night, and I'm like, okay, we got to get this right. But whatever. And on the project, on the cost side, so what will happen on your value of the project for the cost side? So, for example, this developer that I have that does these in the hospitality industry, they're developing this large $290 million project down in the Nashville area. And it's got a hotel, it's got retail, it's got underground and above ground parking, and then it's got a residential both condo and apartment complex. So multi-unit, lots of things going on there in the heart of Nashville. And when they were working through the design, the contractor already started to do excavation, started doing long lead items and everything else. But as the design started to develop and things started moving along, there were significant price increases, some of which were driven by tariffs. And so we had to look to see what did they want to keep and not keep. You know, are we still going to have as many, the term that they use in hotels as keys instead of rooms, they call it keys. Are we going to still have 160 keys, or are we going to reduce it down to 120 keys, which would remove a floor or two? Those are things that they started to look into. When we started getting into discussions with the contractor about tariffs, we said, you know, if a tariff, what we had asked them to bid the project, that it would be the tariffs would not affect it. Meaning, we would rather you give us a higher price now than coming back to us and nickel and diming us throughout the project. Because when you go to your bank, and let's say it's a $290 million project and you're asking for $200 million because you put in $90 yourself, you don't want to have to go back to the bank and ask for more money. They've already got that loan in place. So now you have to find, okay, if there's more over that $90 that we already put in, where am I going to find the angel investor? Or can I get a bridge loan? All these economic things that come into factor. So we'd ask the contractor to bid it as if tariffs wouldn't necessarily rise or go down. Like, whatever your price is, we're going to give you that. So the tariffs go down, and this was before the ruling that said that the tariffs were not put in legally. We said, that's what we'd rather do. And when I worked for Navy Pier in McCormick Place, they would say underground utilities or hazardous materials, things that you can't see before you're on a project site, because nobody has x-ray vision necessarily. We would always ask the contractors to bid for that, to make sure that they built in those prices into their bid, so we wouldn't have to go back to the state of Illinois and ask for more bonds. That's an analysis of what you want to do and how much the money costs. Turned out that the contractor came back to us after we were well into starting construction. I mean, it was early construction, digging holes and things like that. And they wanted a $10 million increase. And we're like, where did this come from? We already talked to them. They're like, tariffs. And we're like, no, we already went through all that. So it was about a 6-8 week negotiation. We finally were able to get to a reasonable settlement between the parties as far as the cost differential and everything else. But that's when you're looking at the value of it and how much money it's going to cost. Because the owner got to a point where they said, we can shave these things off the project, we can get rid of this and get rid of this, but we have to have, and they kept the same amount of keys, because they did the previous analysis, they need X number of keys to generate enough revenue. The hotel had to be enough rooms to generate revenue over the life of the project, or the life of the building, over time for them to make it a worthwhile investment. So all of those things factor in when you're doing that. And if I knew what these two were, and I did last night, and I'm really mad at myself because I'm wondering if I saved it. No, it's probably saved to my drive at my firm, like the. But I'm not connected to the internet here, so I can't pull it up. But it was the first one, so it's the most important one. We'll just leave it at that. I apologize for that. Okay, moving on. The value analysis also involves analyzing the trade-offs between different options. So if two different options have the same cost, but one takes longer to complete, choosing the option that takes less time would be more valuable, or would it? You know? Is it better with the same cost, but takes one longer? You would think it would be the better value, but maybe it takes longer because there are, well, it's the same cost, maybe the materials are what you want. You know? One brick type is available so you can get it done more quickly. This is at a very basic level. The brick type that you really wanted isn't available. You make that analysis, that decision, same cost, but one you have to wait for longer lead items. Same cost depending on the type of the labor that you're going to use, but maybe you are more comfortable with the subcontractor that might be available to do the work. So those are things you want to take a look at. And then the other question you want to ask is, what's the ultimate use of the building, and where might the trade-off supply between a public and private project? And we'll get to that in the next slide a little bit more in detail. But that's the thing is if you're doing a private building, you can get everything you want if you have the money. In a public building, you're going to look at it more of, is it servicing what you need? But at the same time, like I said, when we were doing McCormick Place, because those are actually quasi-public, McCormick Place is its own governmental entity, but it doesn't work necessarily quite like a governmental building, because it generates revenue differently than governmental buildings do. They decided when my contractors bid, I want them to bid more so I don't have to go back and ask for more money. One, I could maybe get a no from the state of Illinois and more money. But two, that's always going to slow down my project. And so it would frustrate me as their lawyer because while I'm not hired to do their financial analysis, I'm their lawyer, I'm making sure their contract is the best and everything else, I know that there are clauses that they're putting in their contract that's going to make the value, the cost of the project more. And so there's a part of me when I work with them, and I do this with all my clients, I'm like looking to see where is the dollars coming from and can I save the company money? Even if I'm not the one that's really doing the cost analysis. And if I look at a clause and I see it's wide open, that it just leaves the contractor tons of wiggle room to get more money, then I'm like, well, are we taking more money from the public? On the flip side, the people that run McCormick Place, the MPEA, the Metropolitan Theater and Exhibition Authority, they've been doing it for decades, and they know what they need as far as how they get the projects done. And so they looked at different trade-offs. A little bit more money going into the project is a trade-off to getting the project done and up and running so it operates and operates for the public that it's designed for. Same thing will happen with, you know, like a courthouse building or anything else, any true public building. So, questions on that? Okay. We're doing the analysis, as I said, the different types of buildings, and there are different thought processes that go in for the different people or organizations or groups that are going to be developing. traditionally, when you're going to look at this, again, if you go back and you do some analysis or some review on the economic equation, they're going to break it up into these four types of building types, four categories, I guess you would say. And like I said, it's based on their economic equation. And what you need to do is compare the relation of the profit of the building to the building's function. So you start with what the intent is, and we have a building, the four different categories that's kind of broken up is the building is purely the function. It's not going to earn anything. It's just a functionality building. Second, it's primarily the function, but also needs to make economic sense. And while I have these categories here, there's gray zones between all of them, and it depends on how you go look at the use. And I'll tell you as we're going through the bullets, I'll break it down and narrow up to go through the four different categories of where and why there's going to be gray zones. Third, it must function and earn through its functionality. And then the fourth one was earned by way of an investment, but needs the function to be marketable. So those are the four kind of general categories. And each category you're in, you're going to be taking those original four questions and then the three other ones that came in the second slide, and you're going to be plugging those pieces into your economic equation. But how those pieces and how those questions are going to be asked will be different from category to category. So let's go back to the first one here. So purely to function, not to earn. We have a single-family home. That's a pretty simple one. We also have, say, a courthouse. That's a public facility. So we have very different entities or individuals that are making these decisions. This is a government that's making decisions. This is one or two people or whatever that you're going to be doing this. So very one. Library may fall into both. It could be a school library. It could be a governmental library, so a school library is going to have a different economic equation of where the revenue is going to be generated from than the government. It's going to like the Harold Washington Library. So we have three, right here, we have three different types of organizations, but they're all going to be looking at this building as purely to function and not to earn. I mean, you buy a library card and you pay fines if they're overdue books, but libraries don't revenue it, generate any revenue. So, anybody have any other thoughts or ideas of like a purely to function? Something that isn't going to generate revenue? Oh, I thought you had raised your hand. I thought you were going to chip in. So. Yes, it could be. Yeah, because it's there. It's going to be operating for helping the non-for-profit people to do their organizations, so it's not fundraising or whatever, but you need to have a space to do that in. So that would be a good one. So, any other thoughts? I know I normally don't ask you guys questions, but I thought today I would a little bit. All right, we'll move on. Think of these other ones when I get there. Okay. Primarily the function, but also needs to make an economic sense. So a hospital, museum, and nursing home. So these are things that you go to a museum to look at art and look at whatever might be there. So that's its primary function. But they do make revenue, and they hold events where they, you know, people after dinner, after evening events, or after hours events, they do fundraisers. They charge you to go there. So it has a revenue generation, but they don't look at that economic analysis, particularly like on a museum, and says, this needs to be a profit center. We don't look at running the shed or the Adler Planetarium as this needs to be something that we're going to be making money. We have to make money to pay our salaries. We have to make money to keep the animals or whatever it is up and running. We have to make sure that it's clean and accessible to the public. But a lot of those are subsidized by other funds that come in. They have donors, they have people that spend money, that donate to charity for it, like a not-for-profit. So that's going to be for a building that's going to function for some things, hospital, nursing home, same type of thing. Now the nursing home may bleed down into here. It must earn through its functionality. So a nursing home and the hospital may earn money, but if you think about it, the majority of hospitals are going to be non-for-profit, but not all of them. There are for-profit hospitals, but so some of these will bleed into here. Same thing up here, a single-family home, it's not going to really earn money, but when you get that down here, maybe, like, as I think about it, part of my, when my kids get through college and my wife and I don't want to be in a larger house anymore, that's part of our retirement. So it does have a long-term financial investment benefit for me. So it can bleed down into the fourth one, but that's not its primary intent. So some of these things, as they say, can cross the lines. Anybody have ideas? Another one here. Primarily to function, but only the functionalities to make economic sense. Excellent. That's really good. I live in Glenview, but we're in the Wilmette School District, so we're out Park District. So there's a Park District. They have classes. That's where my daughter learns gymnastics, and my son learns baseball and those types of things. And so we have this really nice facility. And they actually, what's kind of nice is there was a school that doesn't have a pool. So like Glenview has a pool, and Highland Park has a pool, but the Wilmette Rec Center has never had a pool. An indoor pool. They have an outdoor one, but just it's only revenue generation for the summer. So there is a school like probably a tenth of a mile up the road that recently closed. And they are going to be in the process of purchasing that through the state, through the city, revenue for the city, because it has a pool. And so they're going to expand. But its revenue generation is going to be based on people coming in and paying their dues. And then, like, if you want to swim, you got to buy swim pass if you want to do other stuff like that. So that's a really good one. So, okay, intent. It must function and earn through its functionality. Factory is like the easiest one. Stadium, though. This is an interesting one because stadium can come up here, but especially like if a school stadium. But if you look at Soldier Field needs to, it functions as the football, but there's other teams that will play there from time to time, and it has concerts, and it has other things that they do to make sure that it's earning through its functionality. You know, granted, if you probably look at, and I'm not sure, the NFL might not be the best because there's really, what, eight or nine, depending on 17 games in the season. And if you get into the playoffs, then maybe you get more revenue generation. So you're going to fill the stadium with 60,000 people, and the average ticket price is, you know, Soldier Field is pretty expensive, and the average ticket price is like probably $250, $300. It goes all up to like $1,000 or whatever, but then there's the skybox. But that building doesn't make its money primarily through people attending for 8 or 10 times. When you're owning an NFL team, most of your revenue comes from profit from the television market and from selling jerseys and everything else. But it still has a large revenue component. Now, if you switch to, say, basketball or hockey, the revenue that's generated in the stands is critical for the operation of the team. And then with baseball, they get good financial revenue from the television rights, but also the markets, you got to have the money. So that's why New York and Los Angeles can have these monstrous teams with all these monstrous values and everything else. And then you have a smaller market like Kansas City, they just don't have the revenue because they still, not only not the TV funds, but it's also they don't have as many people come to the games. So they can't charge the high ticket prices, all that other stuff. So you have to look at those different equations for that, but stadiums will largely have this pay-for with its functions, and it earns through its functionality. So that's the same kind of concept there. And as I said, like a nursing home can come down to here. Nursing homes can be not-for-profit. There are a lot of, and I have a good friend, she's a CEO manager. She's actually started up and built half a dozen of these in the Chicagoland area. Actually, the large metropolitan area in Tower Counties. And she principally only likes to work for non-for-profit senior homes because the for-profit ones actually cut the funding more. They want to make profit on it. So the for-profit senior living will fall into here. The non-for-profit will fall into here. And it's like, we know this because when we were moving my mom to her current senior place, she's like, make sure it's in a non-for-profit because you'll get less things taken away. Because not all the time, but a lot of profit senior citizens or adult centers or however you want to call them, they'll look at just the bottom line. You know, so we're going to cut the menu for food. We're going to not have as many outings for them, whatever it might be, because it needs to fall here. It has to be profitable for them. So, again, different things to look at. And then finally, earns right away investment, but needs to function to be marketable. So we have here, we have housing, And as I said, you, like my house, eventually will fall into here when we want to sell it and retire and everything else. Oh my goodness. Are you okay? I was on crutches over the weekend, so I feel for you. So. Yeah. Anyway, so multi-unit housing. So like my developers that are building these hospital or the hospitality ones, they're building the hotels and the condos and everything else. It's an investment. So office buildings can be investment, commercial building, retail, apartments, condos will make and generate revenue over a period of time because you're going to be selling the condos. So that's it's an investment. And that's what we're going to do when we get to the next couple slides. So we're going to take an actual economic equation of a building that falls into this last category. So, any questions on these concepts? Yes?
Would you consider the third category as well?
In the fourth one? I think it would be the third one, very definitely. It could go into the fourth one, I think. But I think not as investment long term, probably. It's probably just going to be third one. Movie theaters, you could put into there, you could put shopping centers, any type of store, like any store you're going to be in, those would all operate as far as making revenue. You know, like when Bed Bath & Beyond went only retail, like, or only online, like, we had a great Bed Bath & Beyond next, like, four blocks from our house, and my wife and I were like, oh, we still miss it, because it was so close, but that's a store that generates revenue through its functionality. So, good idea. Yes? That's a great question. So what does the data center do? Well, data center is going to be, it's functioning, and it's going to fall into this category of storing information, but they're renting that space out on a per gigabyte, per hour, per day, and whatever the traffic is. So that's going to be its functions, and it earns through its functionality. So that's going to fall into the third category. That's a really good one, because obviously that's like everybody talks about data centers now. But one of the things you want to think about, and what goes into it, some of the earlier questions as far as your analysis of the cost and the location and what it's going to impact on society. You know, the biggest thing that we're looking at data centers is how much water it uses to pull from to keep everything cool. And so are we going to be taking the fresh water in areas? I mean, there's some areas where they say they can't really develop a data center because they don't have the water resources to keep the building cool enough because of all the heat that's being kicked out from the machines. And then the other question on the side is like powering it. So like Apple, I know that they, not all their data centers, but like they have a huge one down in North Carolina, and they built a giant solar farm, but it also has both solar and then it has hydrogen power, where they're taking a hydrogen catalyst. I'm not sure exactly the machinery that they're doing, but it generates all the electricity for the data center, and then they actually have excess and they sell it back to the grid. So there's all these different things that when you develop a building, they're going to have a building that falls in Category 3, revenue generator, but they do the analysis of the value of the building over time, how much money they got to spend for upkeep and changing out of the equipment, and then will the cost analysis be good because they're then extra power, because they develop the power grid around it, its own private grid, to then sell back. So it's going to make revenue from that more. Wind farms. You know, I've done a ton of wind farm deals, and these are all on private farmers' land. And so we lease the land from these farmers. We don't own the land because you only need a certain footprint for the wind, for the actual turbine. But then you have to have access to connecting the power cables and underground and how that system goes, so it goes back to the grid. So we're building, it's not a building, but it's a facility or it's a functional machine that its pure functionality is to generate revenue because of the energy that is being created. But in the economic equation, how much do we pay the farmers per year to lease their land? How much do we have to build into the maintenance and operation of those things? So all those factor into the economic equation. And again, we're way up at 30,000 feet. These analyses that they do, I remember the first one that I saw kind of like blurred my eyes. I was brought in on a called an AQCS system. Basically, the whole concept of, I think I may have said this once or twice in class, but the concept of clean coal is clean, coal never is clean. Coal's always going to be dirty. Clean coal is when you burn coal, what do you do with the smoke and how do you deal with that? And so it goes through a systems of both physical filtration and chemical filtration, and there's a factory basically behind it or a filtration system, these multi-million dollar facilities that the smoke is pumped through and then was ultimately released into the air. It's 98% just water. And from when you're doing this with coal, like some of the byproducts they use for is actually gypsum, so they can make drywall, so they can generate revenue making drywall. And fly ash is another byproduct which is used for fire retardant stuff. So there's all these people, they've figured out chemically how to break down the smoke and then generate revenue for it. But when I first looked at one of these cost analysis for the AQCS system, they were two of them, it was a $600 million project, so $300 million each. And they looked at the life value of the building, 30 years, its cost for operation and maintenance, its cost for upgrading, and then you start getting into the details and how much money we're going to make, how much we're going to sell, all the things that went in. And it was pages and pages of just all the revenue and all the spreadsheets of actually, did the economic equation make sense? And it did, for various reasons. Plus, there were governmental mandates that they couldn't have just coal smoke going into the air. So there was that process of it. And so actually, there were pages on the fines if we were outside of certain EPA regulations for the discharge of water versus the smoke going in the air, we would be fine. So all those things come in. We're not going to go nearly into that detail, but that's something, if you're a numbers person and this is interesting to you, you might find yourself in the construction industry doing those types of analyses. So there are people that really love it. Not me, but there are people that really love doing this stuff. Questions on the four categories? Okay. Motives. So, pretty simple. Profit, that's the free market, versus social, the controlled economy. So those are big, and again, they all break down more, but we're just going to keep it at that level. The economic equation, regardless of the motive, must still work to make economic sense. It doesn't make sense if I develop a building that seems really great and all the right values and everything else, and it doesn't make the money that you need. It doesn't make the money to operate or to, because you want it as an investment or to generate revenue, or that you can't afford it, like even a single family home. You're building this home and if you can't afford it, it doesn't make sense. And that's when you got to sit down with the architect and say, this doesn't fall within my budget, which is the simplest word of saying I've already done my own internal economic equation. So, if you're losing money, the economics don't work. So the owner won't continue to maintain the building. That's a fallout. Like, you see these buildings falling in disrepair. In the very last slide we'll have today, we'll talk a little bit about that. Or the building doesn't operate as intended, or the building fails. You know, it shutters. You see a restaurant that doesn't, people don't go to it. People think it's a great idea, but they don't go, so they close the restaurant. Factory doesn't make the best materials, it goes down. The company doesn't make profit. So, did you have a question? Okay. So those are the things that this whole analysis that you're looking into, the economic equation, has to, it's not just, oh, I really want to build this cool candy factory. You know, when Haribo, we built the first one, it's designed and we have the land to do literally like a mirror image next to it. There's lots of lessons learned that we know, things that we did in the first one that we would change in the second one. That always happens, especially when you're developing in a new country and things like that. I was working with Haribo on phase two. They were looking at, this is long before tariffs and everything else, but they were looking at just the economics of U.S. is still their largest growing product area for their candy. So they need another facility here. But they did an economic analysis of, would it be cheaper to build, because they have a factory that operates in Turkey, would it be cheaper to build a second factory in Turkey and ship it in than build the new U.S. factory, because it's much more expensive to build the United States? They build a Turkey factory. They're still going to do another one here, but it got put on hold. We're working on one. I just started in. We're going to be doing one in Marseille, France. Now, that has nothing to do with here. It's for servicing Europe and everything else. But they do these analyses just as far as Even though they're going to build another facility, can they build it elsewhere cheaper and then ship the product in? So it's not to say that they would lose money here, but they did an economic equation where there maybe is it's more profitable elsewhere. So, key players. Again, very, very high level. You're going to have the developer, owner, developer, whatever you want to call it, the market analyst, and then the mortgage lender. You probably would have a financial analyst in there as well, depending on how complex your project is. But for purposes of this, like, let's just talk about kind of residential or something like that, because we're going to do a residential building in a second. Developer often considered to be the owner for purposes of contracts and construction. So when I'm drafting contracts, like, let's say we're doing a condo complex. I know that if there's going to be 50 units in the complex, ultimately there's going to be 50 separate owners. And there may be a group that are already part of the board or a group that want to develop this condo place, or maybe just a company that develops condo complexes. All the contracts that I execute with are going to be where it says owner on the contract, that's the developer, because they own the entire project as opposed to the individual owners that are going to be along the way. But that's the first person. Developer can be owner can be developer. Market analyst, like I said, when you're looking at location, revenue, all those types of things, you're going to bring somebody in for the who, what, where, how, why type of thing. Does it make sense when you're putting in and trying to figure out what's right for the economic equation? Your point about data centers back there, your question about data centers, that's a huge thing. In the market analyst, it's the market, not necessarily revenue market, but it's the area. How far outside of the city, because of the codes and everything, must we develop this? What are we going to be dealing with public backlash? I worked on a data center in Atlanta, and where they outside of Atlanta, but where they were putting it up, the infrastructure was terrible. It was really, really old. So we had to bring people in, and part of the deal with the city where we were developing it was we had to redo all of their infrastructure in the area. It wasn't just electrical. Like, we had to, there was huge water main areas that we had to rip out and redo and everything to service the whole community. So there was quite a bit of additional work. We do a lot of development. I've done a lot of development of data centers in Latin America. We did a couple projects in Mexico. And the areas where we needed to put the data centers made a ton of sense because they didn't have electricity there. They couldn't service the area with electricity. So the data center actually was able to, because we built it, and so people could then get internet and everything else, we brought power, we paid for it, the owner paid for it, from where the power grid was. We built the grid to come into this area. So it was beneficial to the area because a lot more people got electricity that didn't have it, or more electricity. And then the other part was is the local government that had the electrical power, they needed a substation, so a building that actually routes it and monitors it. So we actually built the substation. So it was a $30 million substation that we built, paid for it 100%. I don't remember what all the transmission lines were, but it was like $10 or $12 million. So we put in $40 to $50 million of construction costs that had nothing to do with the data center. And then we gave it all back to the city. We just gave it to them because we knew that the long-term value and where this the product was going to be done, the data center, would over its lifetime would make plenty of money back, more to pay for the data for the substation or the transmission sizes, all those stuff. So again, all those factor into your developer and then working when and where and how and why to make sure that this is a right project. That the, again, I keep repeating those, but the economic equation makes sense. Again, mortgage loading, if you need lending, if you need funding, this could be the government, it could be bonds, what different types of loans, that's, you know, how do you finance it? How are you going to pay for it? That's the thing, your key players you're going to be dealing with. Questions on that? Okay. So now we're at this product, we've got the people together, we got the team, we have this project, we're starting to gather this information. How do we do this? So I told you, I looked at this spreadsheet, these many, many pages of spreadsheets for this AQCS facility out in the Baltimore area, and it was just kind of, when I first looked at it, I got better at reviewing it, reading it. It was a big, giant spreadsheet. So what it was is a pro forma. So here's the pro forma, and you can have pro formas in any type of business. We have pro formas in my firm about how much of the cost of salaries, how much of the cost of rent, how much of the cost of all the other miscellaneous expenses, insurance, blah, 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 revenue generation, partnership money, bonuses, blah, blah, blah. So any type of, when you look at the, it's kind of an overall form analysis of a spreadsheet or series of spreadsheets of how this project, this company, this organization, whatever, operates on a financial level. So, so it's something that you want to put together, and you're going to put together this for a project, or you should, something you're going to be building. And your pro forma will depend on how it looks in the detail and where the categories are important, will depend on which of those four categories you're going to go in. You know, purely the function, revenue to keep it functioning, those four that you're going to look at. At the very highest level here, probably up to 100,000 feet, three big things you want to look at. And we talked about this last week or a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the fee and the firm management and everything else. You're going to have costs, you're going to have expenses, and you're going to have income. And do those things, when we balance the three together, when we put together a pro forma, do those things make sense? Will they work? So, let's take a look at what traditionally on a construction project, again, many of the other line items, but now we're at about 20,000 feet. This is what's going to go on your cost. So, cost for your project, you got to buy the land, you got to have local costs, you got to run power and utility lines and sewer and regular water and all those other types of stuff. Your construction cost, you know, so this goes into the contract, this is your cost of the work. Fixtures, furnishings, and equipment, FF&E, can be part of the cost of the work, but depending on your furniture coming in. One of the things you want to think about, some of the stuff, is if you took your building and you turned it upside down, whatever fell out, that would often go into the FF&E. Now, some fixtures are like lights you put on the wall and stuff, and so they may be part of the cost of the work, but furniture, draperies, whatever, rugs and those types of things, that's going to be a cost that will be separate than your construction cost. Architect and engineering fee, owner's rep fee, my fee, your accountant's fee, miscellaneous costs, storage, burnings, anything else, marketing, because you're going to be building this building, and you want people to come in, it's like we're going to do an apartment building. So how much money does it revenue generate as an apartment and then condo? I used to do it the other way, do it as a condo and then just an apartment, but now condos aren't, there's not as many condos developed, there are apartments, so we're going to do the analysis. So you add all those up, and that's your project cost. So when the owner comes to the contractor, and the owner has a budget for the contractor, that budget's going to fall in these areas here. It's not going to include land, it's not going to include this, or this, or this, or this, or this. It's going to be this here for the contractor, and maybe not even all of this. That's the budget the owner's going to tell the contractor. The owner's going to have a budget that covers all of this, all of these things. That's going to be separate and aside. Contractor's not going to see that. They're not going to know how much really the budget is of the project. So when I talk about like a factory that's $250 million, when I make those comments, or when I say the $10 million strip mall, or whatever I say in these examples for class, largely I'm talking about the construction cost. We get the project cost with a capital P. It includes all these things for the owner to make their own analysis. Most of the time you're going to have a loan. A lot of people don't have the money to just go out and build it. Like I said, Notre Dame, they get enough donors before they do that. That's 1% of 1% of the entities. Most things are done, even on time value money, with a loan. So you're going to have interest on your construction loan. So that's your total cost. Total cost. But your mortgage value is interesting here because your mortgage value is, you're going to pay that down. So you have your total cost and you're going to pay down the mortgage value, and what is left over, so let's say this is $1 million, your total cost, all this stuff is $1 million, and you take a mortgage of $800,000 because you put $800,000, you have $200,000. You have equity in this project already of $200,000. Now, why is that important? Well, remember I was talking about my developer who's doing these hotels and hospitality. They'll go to a bank with already 30, 40% of equity that they've already put into the building. And the bank doesn't have to loan as much money. So it's a much more viable project, and it's going to have more stability, and the risk transfer is better. So, and the owner already has more equity in the project. So something, if he wants to sell it, they can make more revenue and generate more money because they already have the equity. They don't have to pay back as much on the mortgage. But that's your cost tied. So that's on one page of your pro forma, or two or three, whatever it is. But that's the high level, like I said, 20,000 feet of what a cost analysis is. Your expenses. These are the things. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. Question. Let me go back to the slide.
Sorry.
No, that's right. Okay, so one of the things you're going to look at, that's a great question, what is equity? So why is equity important? So the analysis that we're going through here is going to fall into the category of either three or four. So particularly when we get to we're going to have a couple spreadsheets, it's going to be particularly in the category of an investment building. Okay, so what we want to look into, but even when you're a homeowner, any project or ownership you want to have is, as much as you can own it, that you personally own it, that's your equity in the building. So if I finance a project 100%, I have 100% ownership. I'm paying for it. Well, I said finance, I pay for it. If I pay for, like normally when you buy a house, it's traditional to put 15 or 20% down, and the rest is a mortgage from the bank. And the bank holds the title and until you pay it off. And every month I'm paying, like I have 6 or 7, 8 more years left to pay off my mortgage. When my mortgage is finally paid off, I will own 100% and I will have 100% equity. Each time I make a mortgage payment, my equity grows. And so as you pay down your mortgage, your equity goes up. And equity means I get it all, the owner of the project or the company that owns it or whatever. So this is analysis saying when I'm doing this construction analysis, if I take the total cost of my project, which is all these costs here, plus how much interest I'm going to be, the bank is charging me, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever percent interest on the loan that they're giving me. That's my total cost. I take this total cost, let's say it's $1 million. I took a $800,000 mortgage, so I subtract the $800,000 from my total cost. It means I have $1 million building of which I have $200,000 of equity in it. I only have 20% of the equity. The bank owns 80% of the equity. As we pay off the mortgage, the bank's equity goes down and mine goes up. So ultimately, as an investment part, single family homeowner, it's going to be part of my nest egg to retire. As a company that's making this, whether it's the bank, whether it's the football stadium, whether it's the factory, whatever, once they start to own it more, then every bit of revenue it generates is pure profit because they're not paying off the mortgage. Okay? All right, question over here.
What is the biggest collateral for the equity if it's not a realized project yet?
So that's a great question. So what would normally do? Well, so the banks are going to go in, and depending on your credit value and your credit worth in the company, they may ask for something more. It may be just the 20% of the equity in the mortgage, and but they always can foreclose on it and sell it off, and so they have that. Part of the collateral is that 80% ownership. But they're going to look at you and they're going to say, what's the risk value of you as a company? So this company that I said that goes to the bank that's already put 30, 40% of their own money in, that's much less risk for the bank because they know that the investors are really serious. As opposed to an investor that goes to the bank and says, I've got 5%, can I loan 95%? Well, they're going to do a lot deeper analysis and they may have, and I've had a number of projects where they get a mortgage on their house, on the equipment they use, their cars, and I've had to collect on that. I've gone back and had to actually go in and collect, and it's not fun. There was one guy, a contractor, this was on a bond, so it's a little bit different, but the same concept, that to get the bond, which was to secure to get the funds for him to build the project, he ended up, the project was just a mess, and there was lots of problems with it, and we were in a suit with him to try to resolve the problems. I represented the developer. Contractor screwed up in the construction. We were trying to get money from that. We were in the process of the litigation. It was ongoing for a couple of years. And the contractor, tragically, was driving home one night, and it was dark, and he swerved. Nobody knows why. He could have been an animal in the road. He wasn't drinking or anything else. He went off in a ditch, and his car rolled and died. And so we then had to go back on his collateral deal with the surety, which was kind of like a bank, and for the very simple term of this analysis. And there were values to his equipment and to his cars, and it changed our whole analysis of how we did the negotiation, because there was obviously the tragedy involved and everything else, but we had to go and sell some of his cars to pay off the construction costs because he did such a poor job. So there's all different things, but the bank will look at all different analyses to see if you can get that loan. So, questions on any more of this? Okay, so that's your costs. Now, expenses, and cost is going to be during the project, and it'll continue on. Expenses, though, will go forward. And this is when you're looking at the development of projects. So you have your utilities. That's not just during construction. That's actually after the building's up and running, because you've got to pay for the lights and the gas and the power and everything else. I looked at a contract last night for one of my clients' buildings, and it was a chilled water deal. So, like, I don't know if you guys know, like, on the south side of the Loop, I used to be in the Sears Tower. And just to, there's the wedding cake building, they call it the wedding ring or whatever it is called. Then immediately to the south of that, there's this big building, and all it does is make ice. It's a giant ice machine. And what the ice goes up at the top, and then the wind blows on it, and sells cool air, and that goes down, chills water, and that water is pumped throughout all the city to various buildings, and that chilled water goes into the buildings, and they have systems in the buildings that chilled water creates the air conditioning for the buildings. And there's three or four of them in the city, but they're all around different countries, different cities. So, like, this was for in Indianapolis, and I was looking through one. And so that was part of the utility for this building. It's an old building. It could not have been renovated to put in central air conditioning. It was a historic building. So the only way we can get AC in is through the chilled water system. So that's an ongoing cost. Your operation costs. You know, engineer, doorman, this might be for, like I said, an apartment complex, but you're going to have operation costs for a hotel or a factory or anything else like that. Repair and maintenance, management office, marketing, insurance. So all these things, these are expenses that continue during the life of the building. So you have your costs to build the building. Now you're up and running, you have your expenses, so you have to look at the lifetime of that building, and you do it on a year-by-year analysis. So those are your expenses when you're starting to figure out how much that is. So your mortgage retirement, that's how much you have to pay every month. Remember, you got that mortgage on the last page. That's when your cost, the $800,000. How much am I paying a month to pay that off? So you have your operating expenses plus your mortgage retirement becomes your total expenses for this building. And that's going to be on a pro forma as you're looking through the economic equation. Questions on that? And then the third component, again, at the 20,000-foot level, is the income. So after the building is constructed, depending on what category, and again, we're looking at this as kind of like apartments or a commercial building or whatever, as far as for this example, your rental income, if it's an apartment, or even if you're leasing space out for offices, garage rental income, maybe you have garage spaces that you can charge for that. That, when you add these types of things together, gross income. Now, if it's a factory, you're going to get income from selling the products. So that's going to be a different line item. But this is simply whether this concept here that we're looking at is either a commercial building, like a commercial retail building, or a like a office, or a, or it could be an office complex, or it could be a apartment building. So that's your revenue generation here. Then you have vacancies. Like, you're not going to always have 100% vacancy, so you have to subtract that from your gross income. If you had 100% build all the time, great, but you may have vacancies, you have to take a percentage of that. That gives your net income for your monthly cash flow. So you're going to be looking at it when you look at your costs that you're going to have to pay for, your expenses will continue to pay for. Are you going to generate enough revenue to pay with your monthly income to pay for this other stuff? And the cash flow. Again, this would be much larger if we were looking at a stadium or a factory or a movie theater or all this other stuff, because there's so many more factors that are built into it. But I didn't want to get into all those things because I don't really understand it, and that's not the purpose of this. This is just giving you a very basic level of an income stuff. So, net income, minus your total expenses equals profit. And that can also equal percentage of your equity. And we'll go through that in a second of what that means. So, one of the things that I have this in parentheses here, growth is the hidden quantity here. Your total expense, the operational costs, everything else, what's missing in this, but it's figured into this equity thing, is I have a $1 million building. I have an $800,000 loan. I'm paying off my loan. I got my maintenance costs and everything else. So that gives me my equity, my profit. I already have equity because I got 20% in. Plus I'm paying it down. My equity's going up. So that's helping out. But I still have to pay my expenses, so we're all over here. But the value of that building over time, real estate, continues to go up. So that million is not static. Now, the real estate market could go down and that $1 million building is only worth $800,000, or that building could go up and it could worth $2 million and then you want to sell it to somebody who wants to buy it because you can make such a profit on it. So this hidden thing in this analysis that we're looking at it is the growth value of the property or the building. Question?
Can you sell your building and you're still kind of
paid off your mortgage? You sure can. So, like, if I went to sell my house tomorrow, I could. When I do the closing, a check is written, and it's not like they're handing me a check, but there's going to be money that's going to be transferred from banks, and the first person that gets paid off is the bank. So my mortgage to the bank gets paid off, and everything that's left over, I get. And what will probably happen is, because I'm buying in my own place, is a chunk of that's going to go right over to buy the condo that my wife are going to move into or whatever. But yes, the majority of people that sell their houses have not paid off their houses. I would say probably 80-90%. I've never paid off a house. Like, I'm looking forward to someday where I get to say, this is mine, you know. And we pay off our cars. But like, that's the thing. You can sell a car before you've paid off the dealership, but you still have to pay the dealership back. So, yeah. Okay, so one of the things you want to do here is when you want to think about this is when you're looking at this. Oh, question over here, I'm sorry.
I was just wondering, is that common for commercial
properties as well?
Like,
so, like,
owner or developer,
will
go
ahead and
develop
the
property,
have to
be
flashy,
even
though
it's like,
is it common, or is that? Yeah, what will happen is, when a developer develops, and it's kind of come up on a slide, you're going to get two different types of loans. When you're in the construction, because the risks are higher, construction loan is going to have a higher interest rate. And then when you finish developing it, you convert that construction loan into a traditional building ownership loan at a higher, lower mortgage rate. And when you convert that, you have to make sure you're getting enough money on that loan to pay off this initial loan here. And sometimes then, during the process of the project, as if it's a condo and you have to keep going out and you're not selling all the condos as fast as you may need a bridge loan. And so there's another loan that you have to go in because you're paying off the mortgage, or you've already paid off the construction, now you're paying off the mortgage, but you still have to pay for these units that haven't sold, so they're not generating any revenue, so you may need more money because your expenses are higher than you thought, because you thought you'd be selling them off, so you need to get a second loan. So there's all these loan processes that could go in, and it's very, very common. So, and then what you want to try to do, and we'll show this in the very last slide, is if you're in the condo part, you want to see, after I sell them all, what's my profit? Once I've gotten all 100 units, and that's what we're going to do, 100 unit building. If I sold them all, have I made a profit from my investment when the back, when the early time? So. I'm sorry, what? I wish I could tell you that answer, because that's the real estate side of it. So I do the construction, so I don't really get into the financial side of it. So I don't know. But what I will do is I'm going to go into my office, because I have my real estate lawyers are right down the hall. I'm going to ask them. Because I never really, that's a great question. I've never really thought about that. Is it because it's a large, I mean, in some senses you could think, well, economy of scale, I've got a $100 million loan. The bank's going to be making a lot more revenue on me on interest. So would it make sense that the interest rates would be lower for a commercial development than me renting, you know, be borrowing $400,000 for a house? Maybe. But the risks are higher too, so maybe. I just don't know, but I'm going to ask. So the flip side is they know it drives market so they can charge a higher interest because these people really want to develop and they need their money. So it could be higher than me, the average person, buying a house. I'll find out. So, any other questions? Okay, this last part here, the return on investment. So this is where this growth part's into it. So if you have a $50,000 investment, this is really simple, really basic. Like, think of stocks. If you put in $50,000 into the market and it grows to $1 million, you know, maybe you bought Apple at the very beginning or Google at the very beginning or whatever it would be, you have had a 20 times return on investment. Really simple. I invested 50, it's worth $1 million. I got a 20 times. 20 times $50,000 is $1 million. 20 times return on investment. If you have a $100,000 investment and the project grows to $1 million, it's only 10 times return on investment. So those are just things that when you're doing this, one of the things, if you're looking at investment, is what's your ROI going to be? What's your return on investment? Does it make sense if this is an investment product? Are you trying to make money on this deal as opposed to the other categories? I'm operating a museum or I'm operating a factory. Like I said, the majority of this analysis were all in the fourth category that we had in that early slide. That the development of this construction is for investment purposes. Okay, that's your business. You are a developer. You are developing to make money on, and you want to capitalize on your ROI, return on investment. Okay? So, let's do the math. You will not have to do this on the exam, but I want to walk through it. Concepts, there may be some questions asked, like what falls into what category or why would you do this, but I'm not going to put any math equations up there. In fact, I had to redo some math last night because they were off. So, for this, we're going to do it as an apartment building. About 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, it used to be a condo building, and they did it completely differently, but the condos, people sell condos less now and a lot more rental. So we're doing an apartment analysis, and the very last sheet or last couple of slides, we'll do a quick condo analysis. But the detailed one we're going to do here for apartment. Okay? So this is a 12 to 14 story apartment building, and for purposes very simple, we have 100 two-bedroom apartments. So there's not, because like if we had to factor in 3 bedrooms and 1 bedrooms and studios, then you have to have a whole bunch more spreadsheets and pages. So it's really simple. We've got 100 units. They all look the same. They're all 1,200 square feet. And we have 100 parking spaces. So we have 100 for each one of the, each building can get a, each condo can get a, or apartment can get a parking space. And then we have 500 square feet on the first floor for like retail. So maybe a little convenience store, like a 7-Eleven or type things, maybe there's a dry cleaner, something like that. So you can have some revenue generation for that. So that's what we're building, okay? You're the developer. So your hard costs. So this is the cost side, and then there's this hard costs and soft costs. So remember, we have to do costs first, then we're going to do expenses, and then we're going to do income. And then we're going to see if the economic equation works. So those three categories, cost, expense, income, did we do the right thing? Okay. So, cost, land. You got to buy the land. You buy the land, it's $2.5 million to buy the land. So if you think about it, it's $25,000 per unit, the value, even though it's a vertical thing. You just take your value of your land. You bought the property, blank property, for $2.5 million, 100 units, real simple. It's $25,000 per unit for the land. The building, we have 100 units, each of 1,200 square feet, so we have 120 square feet of residential space. That's something you want to think about. Circulation. You need to have quarters and hallways to get around, so we're going to add 20%. So we're looking at a building, as you do this really simple analysis, I want to build 100 units at 1,200 square feet. I need a building that's going to be at least 144,000 square feet, but we got to have some common areas. Maybe we're going to have a lounge, maybe we're going to have a lobby downstairs in addition to where the dry cleaners and the 7-Eleven go. So we're going to add another 10,000 space here, some the elevators, garage, laundry, whatever else is going to fit into here. Add another 10,000 square feet. And then we have this commercial space that we talked about up here, 5,000. So your building is going to be 159,000 square feet, roughly 160,000 square feet. That's what you're building, and that's what you go with at the very basic level to your program. I want to have at least 160,000 square feet to build this building inside the walls. Okay? The garage, let's say it's underground or the first floor or whatever. A couple of the condo buildings that I lived in had first floor garage. So, like I lived in Roscoe, Roscoe Village, and there's an old pencil factory loft, and the Ticonderoga number 2 pencils originally. So I lived in that loft factory. It was really cool. There were these big giant concrete columns in my unit because they had to have the weight for all the machines and everything else. It was very cool, this loft type space, and we parked on the first floor. And so here we have the garage. It's 100 cars, 350 square feet. That includes space for driving around and stuff. So you have 30,000 square foot for your garage area. So that gives you a total, if you're going to look at your cost to develop, okay? So cost to develop a garage is a lot cheaper than cost to develop a space for residential. So we have 159,000 square feet, and you're going to build it out. Means you're going to put in walls and lights and floors and dishwasher, just the basic stuff for the basic unit, and at $135 a square foot. So this is definitely not Chicago. This is going to be somewhere in the Midwest, kind of. And I, like I said, I actually went back and did this analysis 3 or 4 years ago, based on some middle of America towns. So this is something that's doable. So you're going to develop this 159,000 square feet, spending $135 per square foot. This is for you to figure out your budget and your costs. So that's $21,465,000. That's going to be your first cost to build out the building without the garage. Garage, $7,000 or $70 per square foot. So you got to clean, you got to put all the heating in it, you got to put down the concrete, whatever the thing is for your development of it. So we're going to add another $2.45 million for that cost. So your total hard cost to build this 12-story, 100-unit bedroom, 100-unit, two-bedroom building is $23,915,000. That's your hard cost to build the building, hard cost. The other side, we have soft costs, though. Soft costs aren't the actual construction costs, but they're going to be costs when you're looking at the total project cost, okay? So we have a construction loan, and here, for this analysis here, we're going to take a construction loan of 100%. I didn't want to start for going through. We'll get to it later. We'll start splitting it up. But so if you have a construction loan of $23,915, okay, construction loans are going to be a higher interest rate than your normal loan. So if let's say that the interest rate is 3.5%, the market's out there right around now, it's in the 3s and 4s. Construction loans for the last couple of years have been much higher than 7%. But it's not uncommon for a construction loan to be double your traditional mortgage for a building, because there's risks in construction. You have to get it on time, on budget. You might have to have overruns. There's all these things that can happen. So the banks will charge you more for a construction loan. And then what they do is, so if you take 7% of the $23,915,000, it actually is double this value here. But your construction loan, you start paying down right away. So what you do is you have it, because like the interest, this is all the interest here. So the interest on the construction loan, an interest on this, if you do a quick math, it's going to be like $1.7 million. The reason why I have $837,000 here is because you're paying down your construction loan. So while it'll be $1.7 million at the end, it's going to be worth zero. So for the life of the construction project, you just do a half. Again, very simple. Does that make sense? I'm doing that because you start here, you're going to end it here. And so you just, and let's say it's not going to be a straight curve, but for our analysis, it's a straight curve. So you just take right dead in the middle to say that's going to be for my soft costs. I know I'm going to be incurring $837,000 in interest payments during construction. Okay? The lender's fee, they're going to charge points. You guys probably heard of points. That's one thing that, and this I can answer you on this. Most of the time when you're closing out a residential project, a residential buy, when you buy your home, then I've never had to pay points. Points is just another fee that the bank will charge. Most construction loans and real estate loans will have points on the commercial and in that area. So this is 1.5 points here. You can be up to 3 points here. Most like I said, if you buy your own house, it's going to be a 0 point. And you shouldn't be paying points. If somebody comes to you as a mortgage broker and says, you're going to have to pay a point, go get another broker at this point. If it was in the 80s, you'd have to pay points, but it's much different now. So we have a point and a half here. And so that's a point and a half taken off the $23 million. So it's another $358,000. That's a soft cost. The architect's fee. Here, remember we did last week, or 2 weeks ago, when we did the office management calculation, we were doing what the architect would charge. I think we started at 5%, and we ended up at like 6.5% before the architect could make money off of this. This architect, somehow they must be really good because they're only charging 4% of the total construction costs. So we could do it at more, but right now the architect's going to get paid roughly $1 million on this $23 million project, the $24 million project. Got to pay the lawyer, you got to pay marketing, miscellaneous accounting, everything else like that. So your soft cost for this project is just under $2.4 million. So we add soft costs and hard costs. So your total project cost, that very first page of the pro forma, is $26,287,000. So you have to have, between your own equity, your own money you're putting into it, and the bank loan and everything else, you have to have that money. Okay? That's your costs. So for income, we're going to look at an income. Oh, there's the expenses. I'm sorry. I was like, I thought I had expenses here. For your income, so for this thing, we're going to try to see, will this project, as we have mapped it out, will it make money for us? So we're going to charge $1,600 a month for rent. I know you guys would all love to see that rent in the city of Chicago. I probably know it's not the city of Chicago. But we're going to charge $1,600 a month for rent. And here's another thing that's not factored into this, but you would factor into it. You're going to be able to rent the units on the top floors more than the lower floors, even if they're exact same units. So there's all these things that factor into it. Again, this is like basic, simple. Every single unit is going to get $1,600. So you are going to generate revenue of $1,920,000 a year, plus your parking spaces at $200 a month. So, and then commercial rent, because the 7-Eleven and the dry cleaner are going to pay you over a year, they're going to pay you for this $100,000 in the lease for them to operate their business. So your total income, that if everything was 100% just going perfect, would be $2.260 million a year. That's how much revenue you would generate from this building. But you're not always full. There's a couple of units of the 100 units, that, you know, 5 units haven't been rented out on the time. So we have a 5% vacancy. So we subtract that because you're not getting any revenue from those units. And so for this analysis, we have a total income of $2.147 million. Okay? Now, expenses. So we got to pay for management, salaries, utilities, maintenance, taxes. For that, as a swag, just a ballpark, it's not uncommon to say that it's 40% of your income. So we take 40% of the $2.147 million, and you're going to have expenses here of $858,000. Now, what happens, and remember I was talking about for-profit and non-for-profit? These are the This is where private people will try to make money, and they'll try to get this smaller, and so let's make it 35% or 30%. How can we cut our expenses so our income and our profitability is better? This is where things get cut out. And so if you're operating a business for people, for public and everything else, then businesses get run down, or buildings get run down, or the services you get run down because they don't necessarily put in the proper money for the expenses. For retirement, that's not going to change. Remember here, so he has, for this one, what we did is we had the mortgage loan was the $23,915,000, but we, for this analysis, put in the soft costs. So our total, remember, was $26,287,000. So this is like $26.3 million. Because the mortgage was only on the $23.9 million, it's roughly 15% of equity that we have in the building. So, but the mortgage retirement is that we're going to be paying, when you take this 85% of that, so this is your value of your mortgage that you're carrying, and then you multiply it times your interest rate. So this is what the bank is charging you for your mortgage retirement. So it's at 6%. This could be 4, it could be 3. This will fluctuate year by year. So for this analysis, I took 6%, and probably because I did this last year because the mortgage rates were pretty high. You know, they've come down this year, but last year they were up here. So for the analysis here, I did 6%. So you're going to be paying the bank every month $1,340,000. Or no, over the year, $1,340,000. So your total expenses here for a year is $2,199,455. Your income is $2.147. Your expenses is $2.199. So now we have, and the expenses pays for the cost of the building. So this mortgage retirement is how I pay for the cost from the page before. So the expenses of $2.199, but your income is only $2.147. That doesn't seem good. And I put it on the next page so you can see that. So income $2.147, expense $2.199, you're losing $52,455 a year on this project. Every year. So, you had equity at 15% in this analysis, we had 15%. So what you had when the building opened, you had $3.9 million of equity in this $26 million building. Okay? You're losing $52,455. So to figure out whether you're winning or losing money, you do an analysis. You take your loss or gain, you divide it by your own equity, not by the value of the building, your own equity in the building, and it comes out to be 1.3. So you are losing, you're getting a loss of 1.3% per year. So your investment is going down 1.3% per year. Now, remember, what's not in this analysis, and it would be in a very much more complex one, is their building will still increase in value. So this $26 million will go up because the building itself will increase in value if you're in a neighborhood where the value is going up. If the value goes down, then it's going to be worse, so you're going to be losing more money. So there's different ways to look at that. I don't put in the increase in the market just because it's just much too complex, but you can see you would do that. So this is a really bad investment of what you've planned it to be. So what do we do? What do we do? And this I'm going to ask you guys. Give me an answer. How do we make this a better investment? We still want to develop a building. What do we change? Rent, which is income. It's exactly right. We have to figure out how to generate more income. And that's what we do in the next one here. Try higher rent. Perfect. So instead of $1,600 a month, we're going to charge $2,000 a month. Still really cheap if you guys are in Chicago, but it's not. So we're going to get, instead of $1.9 million, we're going to generate $2.4 million. You're not charging anymore for the garage space. It's still $200 a month. Commercial is still the same. Subtotal. Your vacancy, you're going to be getting, this is higher, the other one was 113, but this is higher because you're charging more rent. So you're getting less debt. But now we have a total income of $2.63 million. So we come down here, and this is, again, another place where you look at not only will they cut costs, but let's say that as a building goes on and your rent increases, so you're in an apartment building, and your rent increases every year, that's not uncommon. It goes up once a year, and blah, blah, blah. Yes, there's going to be costs for the doorman or whatever. They're going to get a raise, and so the cost of living thing goes up. But what will happen for this analysis, you still should take 40% of your total income. But what will happen is this total income goes up, and this is where they can start shrinking, because maybe the rent increase is by, you get an 8% rent increase, but they only give a 4% increase to the salary of the workers. So that's where you can start to, I won't say play with the numbers, but where you can get better revenue or better income coming in, because maybe it's okay that it's less than 40%, but it's not wrong to try to do, and you should try to do this 40% of your total income. So now what we're getting here, these are the costs, the expenses. So you got $1,041,000 for your expenses. Mortgage retirement's going to stay the same, because the mortgage is still what it was originally, still 85%, it's still 6%. So this stays the same, the $1.3 million. But now we have total expenses of $2.381 and $2.6 million. So just under $2.4 million, but $2.6 million of income. So now we have more income, then we have expenses. And again, that expense includes your hard construction costs. So, here, now we're making $221,000 per year. So we're making money. But is that the better investment for you? Is that the right investment? Have we moved the needle in the value of the rent enough? Have we increased our income enough to make it a good investment that will return our investment? So we do the same math. We take the equity, a 15% equity in a $26.3 million building, so you have $3.9 million equity in it. You do the division, the gain per year. It was a loss, but gain per year. And so now we have 056. So now you have a 5.6% gain every year without thinking of the value of the building going up. So you're making 5.6% on your investment. So the question is that a good investment? It's not a great investment. You're making money, for sure. And in the long run, because of the value of the real estate you hope goes up, it's an even better investment. But you could take that money, because remember, you could take that $3.9 million, that's the money value of your equity, and you could invest it in the market. And if you look at the market over the last 25 years, it's increased 10% every year over the last 25 years. Markets have its risks. Real estate has its risks. All things have different risks. And so it's where you want to make your money. So, but if you just took it and took it to an investment manager and said, here's $3.9 million invested for me, you would probably make, most likely given, and I know it's been up and down and everything's swinging now, but you would make more money as an investment in the market than the way this is set up, because you have 5.6% interest here that you would make. This would be a 10% increase. So those are factors that are going to fit into it when you're a developer and you're looking at it. But is this a quick turnaround? Do I only want to make the money in a year, or do I know I'm going to be holding this building for the next 25, 30 years where every year my rent goes up and every year this 5.6 gain goes up because, one, your equity goes up in the building because you're paying down the mortgage. Two, as the rent goes up, your income comes in. And so this goes up from year to year. So that's when you start to look at it as a developer. Will I have it for the long haul and make the money? And so that's what we talk about here. Consider the real estate increases more rapidly than the value of the money in the bank or otherwise. So that's when you're going to be looking at. All of these factors fall into the economic equation. What questions as a developer, what type of building, why you're doing this, will it be the thing that will satisfy what you need out of it economically? Again, I didn't look at my house as an income generator for me. I didn't look at it as an investment for me, other than it's a really nice place for my wife and kids. We're in a good school system, and it's a nice place to live, and we have a place for our dog, and it's really, I'm very lucky to have this house. But I do know long term, when I finally pay off my mortgage and we sell it, that will help us for retirement. But that's not the purpose of why I bought it. So I don't look at this 5%, 6%, I don't look at that. But all the clients that I represent that are developing buildings, residential buildings, that's what they're looking at. And how long do they stay in? I have one of my partners, and I've worked on his deals too. They were in the condo building business for a long, long time, and then they switched, and now they're in the apartment business. And what they do is they develop their apartment buildings. They're anywhere between 100 to 200 units, multi, like they'll have single, they'll one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedrooms, and they mix it all up. They will own the building for anywhere. They're different. They don't just build it and then sell it to a real estate company. They'll sell it, develop, they'll build it, develop it, rent it, and they will be the owner of the building for about 3 to 5 years. And then they'll sell it to a real estate company before the building itself and the cost for upkeep and maintenance start to drive more costs, because the older a building is, more maintenance you put in. So they make pretty good money, but not as long as they might make it long term, and then they build another one. So their model is develop it, generate revenue, sell it at its peak value, and then build another one. Some people are in the market of buying them and leasing them out for years. So, Questions on this? Again, we won't do any math, but there are going to be questions on concepts that I'm kind of talking about here. You know, when I talk about, I'll give you an example. I'll give you one that you guys should, there will be a question in the test, kind of like we did the hierarchy. There's going to be a question in the test that's going to be like, which of the following are an expense? Or which is a cost? So there's going to be stuff like that. So those pages of cost, expense, and income, those things you should make sure you have play. Those are the types of things. Some simple questions like that. But there may be some questions that will be talking about, like, if you're going to be doing a functionality building, what are the things, and there'll be some questions like, what are the things that are important to now analyze in that? Kind of the examples I've been giving. Question?
Is the real estate increased value not factored into what this percentage gain for your investment?
It is not.
It's not, because it's so hard to predict. Like, it depends on what's going to happen in the neighborhood or whatever,
right? It's mostly because it was a lot more math for me, and I could have put in a real estate. I could put in a really simple factor of your market value increases at a 3% interest per year, and I could do a straight line graph. I could do all of that stuff. I just didn't want to get into it too much like that. Because that, I mean, the concept is there. Like, what I want you to understand is, I want you to understand that for all these investments, for these buildings, there is hidden, not in any of this math, but there is a hidden component of the value the real estate will increase. As a result of that, your mortgage is never going to go any higher. Your mortgage goes down because you're paying it off, but the value of the building goes up. So let's take that very basic example. $1 million building, you put $200,000 in, and you have an $800,000 mortgage. You have 20% equity. You pay off $100,000 of that $800,000 mortgage, you have a 30% equity. But the building is not worth $1 million anymore. The building is worth $1.1 million. You now have $400,000 of equity. $200,000 you paid in initially, $100,000 that you paid off your mortgage, and the value of the building went up. So now the mortgage is $700,000 and your equity is $40,000. So it's not 30-70, it's going to be that, I'm not really good at that math real quick, but that's what's going to happen. So I didn't factor that in, but that's always going to, well, not always. It will always be factored in the value of the building. It won't always go up. Sometimes neighborhoods go down, and then the value of your building goes down. You hope you're not in that, and that's when you go to your market analyst in the very beginning. You say, we're building this building here. What do we think? Is it an up-and-coming neighborhood? Is it a place that needs a service? Do we need a restaurant here? Do we need this? Do we need that? Whatever it might be. So your back-of-the-napkin analysis says, not only am I going to be generating revenue, not only am I going to be paying down my mortgage so my equity goes up, but the value of that building on its own is going to go up. So if and when I have to sell it, my equity is, you know, it could be, the goal is, and it'll be for my house, at least so far, when I sell my house, I will have, granted, I've paid in a ton of interest over the life of my mortgage, too, because it's, and that's the other thing, is when you pay your first, I don't know how many people own your houses here, but, like, let's say you have a $1,000 mortgage, a $1,000 a month mortgage payment over 30 years. Your first payment is like maybe like $78 of your $1,000 you gave to the bank goes to your principal, and the rest all goes to interest. And the next month it's like $81, and the rest is all principal or all interest. And so over the life of the mortgage, eventually you're paying more principal than interest. So that's all amortized and everything else. That's why I don't get into all that. It's just a straight line here. You're paying this much a month, and this is. But again, when I sell my house, I will sell it for significantly more money than we originally paid for it, at least where the market is right now. I already know my house has gone up like 40% of its value since we first purchased it, which is great. But, you know, and I live in an area where I think it'll continue to hold its market. You never know, but the goal is when eventually will we move in 20 years or whatever it is to downsize. It'll be worth a lot more. Cost of living will have gone up, and the cost of everything else goes up then too, but hopefully it'll be increased more, and then that goes to our retirement. So, anyway. I have just one last, I think it was one last slide. Two. Three. Okay, so, this is doing it really quick as a condo. So, like, I don't have all the pages for the condo. So here, same hard cost, same soft cost. And so what you're going to be doing is you sell each one of your unit, your broker is going to be charging you a percentage. This is your real estate broker, legal surveyor. subtotal. So your cost when you're going to be doing this building is a little bit more. But you want to make profit on this one too. So you want to say, you want to get a 15% profit. That's your goal in selling the condo unit. So instead of that 5.6 year after year after year, you're going to be trying to sell these condos in the first year. So you've set up your budget, your market, and say, I want to make 15% profit on my investment. My investment for this condo building, a little bit more than the apartment building, because you're going to be paying every unit that's being sold. Because you get 100 units, each time your broker sells a unit to an individual unit owner, that's where they're charging this 6% here. So your costs are going to be a little bit higher. You want to get this profit, so your total, which you're looking into so you can come with profit, is $32 million. Remember, the total before was $26 million, but now we've added in profit, a little bit more from a broker. So your $32 million here is the nut you want to make sure you're making 15% profit. So $32 million divided by 100 units, that means you've got to sell your condos at $325,000 per condo for you to make this much money. So, it may be a good investment. To 50%, it may not be. Like, you know, again, I don't know how many condos in, like, downtown Chicago you can get for $320,000 that are 2-bedroom, 1,200 square feet. I don't know, but it's been a while since I've been in that market, but that seems to be pretty cheap in this market, but maybe not. But that's what you'll need to do in this condo analysis. For you to make 15% profit, each unit has to sell for at least $320,000. Really simple on that one. Cost, another thing that you want to think about, again, this goes into the expense side, whether it's ownership is a private or ownership is operating, care for the building. If you get into issues, problems, apartment buildings, landlords don't maintain, slumlords cost. These are things where you can get into problems in litigation and things where your building can't generate revenue because the value of the building goes down because you're not keeping it upkeep. The litigation scenario here, condemnation litigation, developers cut corners and they oversell, attorneys scare boards into lawsuits. Like, I've had so many condo associations over my career call me up and they want to sue because somebody that lives in their building is a lawyer and they're on the board. They know nothing about real estate and they know nothing about construction. And they may not even be a litigator and they just want to sue the developer. You know, air conditioning is not going to do it. And so that's a lot of expense. And what happens is if you're living, especially if you're living in an apartment or even in like a co-op or whatever, you have to pay assessments every month. Well, my legal fees go into that. And so I've worked on a number of projects where we sued the contractor or the developer, and then we're halfway through the suit and the residents are up in arms because they're paying my legal fees. And it was because and it doesn't happen all the time, but I've had plenty of lawyers on board to try to stiff-arm their association into litigation. So those are all things that factor into. This is less of the development economic equation. This is if you're continuing to own and costs and expenses that would occur going forward. So, and that is it. Questions? All right. Thanks for showing up this week. I know last week, 2 weeks ago, there was like only 6 of us, 8 of us. It was great. So I bought everybody lunch. No, I'm just kidding. So donuts or gummies next week? Donuts? Donut here? Okay. I'll bring some donuts next week. We're going to do the A201. I will send that document out, just the regular one. Take a look at it before. Again, it's...